Good evening. My name is Tiffany, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I'd like to welcome everyone to the Midwest Regional Teleconference Series Coping with Change conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Collins, you may begin your conference.
Thank you, Tiffany. Good evening, everyone. My name is Lisa Collins, and I'm from the Greater Illinois Chapter of the National MS Society. And on behalf of the Society, I would like to welcome you to tonight's program, again titled Coping with Change. This program is brought to you through a collaboration of the Greater Illinois, Gateway Area, Indiana, and Mid-America chapters. Together, we provide programs, services, and research to improve the lives of people affected by MS. Recordings of this call will be available through each chapter for anyone wishing to refresh their notes or share with a friend. I would also like to mention there is a wealth of opportunity made available by the Society through your local chapter for all levels of participation. And we encourage you to reach out to your local chapter by calling 1-800-344-4867 or by visiting their website for a listing of upcoming events and programs. We would also like to take a moment to thank our program sponsors, Bayer Healthcare and Biogen IDEC, for supporting portions of this series. Please note that during the first part of the program, during our speaker's presentation, you will be in listen mode. Feel free to jot your comments and questions down as you listen. Dr. Morris will pause during her presentation to allow the operator to open the lines for anyone to ask their questions. She will continue her presentation with all participants returned to listen mode. We ask all participants with questions to limit their time to one question per request so that as many participants as possible may enjoy a direct response from Dr. Morris. And we are fortunate tonight to have as our speaker Dr. Jerry Morris. Dr. Morris has served for the last 25 years as a faculty member at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine in the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. She has worked closely with many individuals with multiple sclerosis over the years, doing psychotherapy and evaluations, and she is a former senior psychologist at the Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago. In addition to being a clinical psychologist, Dr. Morris is also a board-certified neuropsychologist. She has authored more than 50 journal articles and chapters while continuing to teach courses offered by the Rehab Institute of Chicago to professionals from other institutes on topics such as adjustments to severe disabilities. I now welcome Dr. Morris to begin this evening's program.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be able to speak with you this evening, and I look forward to your questions at the end of my talk. Tonight I'm going to be speaking about coping with change, and from my view, requires thinking about the idea about how we can be resilient, because life, let's face it, life is hard, and we need to be resilient to deal not only with future issues and things that might happen down the road someplace, but also with current things that are going on a day-to-day basis in our lives. And essentially, we need, of course, to enjoy the good times, but to hold up to adversity. And adversity comes to us from many places. Sometimes it comes from without ourselves, in other words, things that happen to us that we really don't expect or can't control. And one of the things that I realized in working with people who have various disabilities is how important it is to underscore the fact that adversity doesn't just come from the illness itself. In other words, you may have multiple sclerosis, but that's not going to be the only problem that you encounter in life. And I learned this in a way that was really kind of interesting for me anyway, because it made me think about myself and my own views. But early when I was working at the Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago full-time years ago, one of the first patients that I had when I was there was a fellow who was a quadriplegic. And I saw that he was in quite a good mood during his stay. This was a rehabilitation stay, inpatient stay. And what I saw was that he wasn't as depressed as I might have expected. In fact, he wasn't depressed. He seemed to adjust really well to things that went on. And then one day, he was taken for a procedure where he had had a halo that he wore on his head, which was a kind of brace, a metal brace, that was there to keep him stable in terms of his neck so that he wouldn't injure himself even more. And they took it off, and when he came back, that's when he got depressed. And I thought, what is this? And realized that he had certain expectations of what would happen, and they didn't occur. And I noticed that other people had, like they might have a brief period of time where they had to lie down on a gurney because of a pressure sore or something that occurred that kept them immobilized, even if it was only for a few days, and that they were depressed then when they hadn't even been depressed before then. And so I gave a lot of thought to what was this that was making the person so have such a strong reaction when they hadn't seemed to have such a strong reaction to the things that had happened before that. And what I came to realize from talking with people and thinking about it a lot was that many times many of us have a sort of delusion, and that is that we're going to pay our dues, and that whatever it is, the illness, or in that case it was an injury, that was, in a way, without realizing it, people felt that they had paid their dues, and when other adversity came to them, it was very depressing because they realized it was not the last bad thing that was going to happen to them. And that, in fact, having MS or having any disability doesn't exempt you from facing all of the other, from having all of the other bad things happen to you in life that do occur. So that adversity can come from not only having a relapse or doing more poorly than maybe you were at some point, but also from just the ordinary things that happen to people and having to face those. So that life is hard, and we need to be resilient very often, even in a period of time where maybe the illness isn't what is giving you such a challenge. So we never finish paying our dues, and also we have to hold up against adversity that comes from within our own selves. And by that I mean that what we think and what we feel can bring us down and can make us unhappy and can present as something that's difficult for us to cope with. So that we have ups and downs that occur even if the rest of life is staying the same. And we aren't the same at every moment. Sometimes we deal a little better than other times. And so we have to cope with all of the changes that come to us from without ourselves, and also those that we kind of, that come from within ourselves. So that we need to be resilient so that, in particular, that we don't suffer more than is necessary from the kinds of stress that can contribute to ill health, for example, or that can interfere with us being happy, being productive, being able to feel good about our lives and about ourselves and the world around us. And also, we need resiliency so we can maintain a positive relationships. And I want to focus on the positive relationship issue because I think it's so important. Because we have relationships with other people, and I think that when I say relationship, typically we then envision our relationship to someone else. But we also have a relationship with ourself, with our own self. And I want to develop that concept because I want to make some suggestions about that and emphasize the importance of our relationship with ourselves in terms of being resilient and being able to deal with change and to cope with what happens, whether that is from without or from within ourselves. And so that we need to think about, I think, the importance of our relationship with our own self, not just with other people, and how we develop self-esteem because our relationship with ourself is going to be based on how self-esteem means how do we judge ourselves, basically. That's what esteem is. Where do we consider ourselves in terms of how we judge ourselves? So I'm going to return to that idea of self-esteem in a few minutes. But before I do, I want to acknowledge something important about coping and about change and about how we deal with it. And that is that in order to think about this, we first need to acknowledge that in life, there are simply parts of the world that we cannot control. So it isn't even just your illness, but we can't control if the ceiling is going to fall down in the next minute or a tornado happens or whatever. And so there's really some things that are outside of our control, and no amount of holding our breath is going to be able to help that. And I think that an example might be, some percentage of the people who are listening are probably terrified on airplanes. And I had an experience not that long ago where I'm on an airplane and they seated this young woman next to me. And she was a very sweet girl returning to college. And she said to me before takeoff, I'm phobic about airplanes and I'm afraid I'm going to have a panic attack. And I thought to myself, well, they sat you in the right seat. So I told her, of course, that I was a psychologist. And I talked her through the experience and taught her a little relaxation technique that she could use when she tried it again. But one of the things I also pointed out to her was that she wasn't really going to be able to control whether the plane flew or not by holding on to the armrests harder, and that actually doing that was making her more tense and more upset and more nervous. So it's important, really, when we think about coping and what makes us resilient, first to acknowledge that there are parts of the world that we cannot control, and that when we focus our efforts on trying to control them, not only are we more tense and more upset, but it isn't effective, it doesn't work, and we end up not focusing on things, actually, that we could do to help ourselves. And so actually, there are three categories of things in life, and that is those things that we cannot control at all. Then there's a group of things that we could a little bit influence sometimes if we're lucky and try real hard, and that's other people. We cannot really control other people, as we all know, and I think lots of times we'd like to, but it doesn't work very well. And those of us who are parents certainly appreciate the fact that there were plenty of times we might want to or might have wanted to control our children, but we didn't get to do that, and our spouses and our friends. But we sometimes can influence them to some degree if we work at it and we're fortunate. So what actually can we control in life? Well, the category of things that we can control in life is what we think and what we do. And it really comes down to that. We can't control, to some degree, you might influence, for example, how stress affects your illness, or you may make choices about how other things affect your illness, like seeking out a physician or taking the appropriate medications when you should and those sorts of things. But there's still a limit to how much you can control your illness. And so what can you really control? You can control what you think and what you do. So I'm going to address that very aspect of life and of coping, of how we can control what we think and how we can then learn to cope through what we think. And I'm going to suggest a way of thinking about this that I hope will give you food for thought and that will be of use to you. And that is I'm going to suggest that how we go about doing that is by learning how to parent ourselves adaptively. So that may seem like a strange idea about parenting yourself, because usually when we think of parenting, we're thinking of being a parent to someone else. But we have this relationship with ourselves. And at some point or other in our lives, either because we've left home or our parents, of course, were not perfect, being human beings. They weren't perfect. And they, so naturally they didn't completely finish the job. No one's parent prepares them fully for having MS, for example. It wouldn't be possible. First of all, they probably didn't know, and they didn't have enough information, and they didn't think to do it, and it wasn't a focus of anything. And so there are plenty of things about that aspect of your lives that they didn't address. And even at, well, aside from that, because your whole, you are not just your illness. You have whole lives. You are complete, whole human beings. And each one of you is unique and different from each other, so that there's much more to you than only your illness. But your parents didn't prepare you for every aspect of all of the rest of you either, because they didn't know how, they couldn't, they didn't have time. Maybe you didn't even want to listen to some of it and now don't remember. And anyway, they're not there with you every minute anymore, providing you with their two cents, which you probably wouldn't want to hear about anyway at this point, at least a lot of the time. So at some point or other in our lives, we have to start parenting ourselves. And I want to explain what I mean by that and how one goes about doing that. So it might start so that it might sound funny at first, the concept of parenting yourself, but this is what we all actually do. And through parenting ourselves, we could build our self-esteem. So I'll return to that later. I want to address one aspect of self-esteem now, actually, and that is self-esteem. What is it? It's how well we like ourselves. And I think that very, very often in life, people mistake self-esteem and other esteem and confuse the two. In other words, many people think, well, I take my idea of who I am from what other people think of me, so that you might not think that consciously, but I think that it's very common for a person to think, oh, they don't like me, there must be something bad, or they don't approve of me, or they don't think this about me, or they think something is not good enough about me, and therefore I'm not okay. And actually, there is a big difference between what other people think of us and what we think of ourselves. And this is worth spending time thinking about. If you're not accustomed to thinking this way, it's really, I suggest, worth spending some of your time in your own private time thinking about how you make that separation of what other people think of us and what we think of ourselves. So that, just to give you an example of what I'm saying, I'm exactly the same person whether someone likes me or they don't. Now, believe me, I would prefer they like me. And why? Because then I can have a relationship with them. Or let's take this situation. First of all, I have zero feedback from you guys. Usually when I do a talk, I'm standing in front of people, and I can kind of see, are they frowning? Are they smiling? Are they nodding? I'm getting zero feedback. So it's possible that at the end, when you are asked for feedback, or maybe during the question period, it will come out that you feel very negatively toward me, all right? So what can I do with that is I can understand that that's how you feel, or try and understand it, and I might feel very bad about that. However, nevertheless, I am the same person, and not all of you are going to have the same opinion. Some people will like me, some people will not like me, so that if I try and take my opinion from what other people think of me, I'll be kind of whipped around from one place to another, and mostly people remember the bad things that people think or say or whatever, and bad feedback that they get. But the fact is that each of us are exactly the same person, and not everyone, whether other people like us or they don't. And we do, as I say, and I want to admit that we care whether other people like us. I'm not saying we don't care about that. We care because we want to have relationships with people. We want to be able to, have all kinds of different relationships and do well. But that's not the same as what we think of us. So that I will go into elaborate that more. but I'm emphasizing right now that there's a boundary issue, and as psychologists, that's kind of a psychological expression, but we speak about boundary issues, and what we mean by that is I know the difference between myself and you, and so that you could have one opinion and I can have another. And it doesn't mean that I'm necessarily going to stubbornly maintain my opinion, but it means that I can have a kind of continuity of opinion. My opinion of me can be more stable over time, and I'm not just at the mercy of whoever I interacted with last. I'll take an example that maybe many of you experienced when you were younger, and I really don't even know the ages, but I'm picturing that you're adults, but that could be not true. But at any rate, just because of the demographic of MS, but at any rate, when you might think back to your teen years when you went on dates, and or you wanted someone to ask you out, or you asked someone out, and I remember my son, my older son, and he wanted so much to ask out this girl, and every day he would not have the nerve to call her. And I asked him why that was, and basically he said that he was afraid that if he asked her and she said no, then the next day when he went to school, everyone would laugh. I pointed out to him, by the way, that maybe not everybody would laugh. Most people wouldn't care, and they wouldn't even know about it, et cetera. But the point is that at that moment, it seemed to him that person, that girl, had the power to decide whether he was an okay person or he wasn't. His asking her out was a test of who he was as a human being. And what I'm suggesting is that it may be a test of whether that person likes us or not, or whether someone else approves of us or not, or whether we get to do this or that, or we get to have a relationship or we don't. But it isn't a test of who we are as a human being, because we know more and have more information about ourselves than that. And furthermore, because we get to be the ones who decide what we think, and I'm going to go into this in a minute later, but because we get to decide what we think and what we do, we get to opt to think and do things that are in our own best interest, doing things that make us feel that make us approve of ourselves. If we approve of ourselves, regardless of what the next person does, that is self-esteem. That is the basis of self-esteem, is having positive regard for ourselves, not the same thing as someone else having positive regard for us. You know, I hadn't thought about stopping here, but I think I'm going to. Do you think that I could stop just for a minute and see if people are following along, or they might have a question, or since I don't have any feedback yet, am I clear? Does anyone have any questions? Could I open it for 1 minute?
Certainly. Tiffany, would you be available to assist this process?
If not, I'll keep talking. Should I keep talking?
You should be able to open the line to just inquire again. It's the star and then 1 on your keypad for all those listening.
Correct. And we have a question from the line of Journey Lasher.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to tell you that it's making sense what you're saying, and I'm totally following you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I just wanted
that.
To give you some feedback
you.
About that. Like, I didn't ever realize there really was a difference between self and other esteem.
Oh,
so
perfect.
You totally clarified that for me.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
You know what? Okay, I'm going to go back. At least someone understands. And everyone else didn't call up to say, what in the world are you talking about?
Yeah.
So I'm going to go on. So, yes, okay. I think that we're not really taught to think about any of the things that I'm going to bring up today. I think that there's all kinds of things we should have courses for in school that we don't, but at any rate, how to parent yourself. We aren't even taught how to parent other people, much less ourselves. So at any rate, so in terms of self-esteem, so in terms of what we do, I'm just going to address that issue first, because I want to spend more time on what we think. If we want to have self-esteem and we want to think well of ourselves and we want to prove of what we do, then we have to choose doing things that we respect. So this may seem perfectly obvious, But if you want to respect yourself, you need to conduct yourself in a way that you can respect. And I don't mean to be giving a moral lecture. I don't know what that is for any one particular person. We're all different in what we think would be appropriate things to do. We can figure that out by watching the news. We see that apparently a lot of people have very different ideas of what's an appropriate thing to do than we do, because we're constantly amazed at what other people are doing. So that this is a very personal thing, but you know yourself what you approve of and what you don't. And so that we can use that as the yardstick of what we choose to do. So, and we already have that that within us. We have our standards, and we know. So we can't control the outcomes, but we can control our choices and our actions. But the other thing that we can control is what we think. And so having a positive regard, I'm going to say something different than maybe you think I'm going to say, because I think that most people, when they think of having positive regard and a psychologist telling them how to have positive regard, they think that that person is going to tell you how to have positive affirmations. For example, like Stuart Smalley, if you remember from, or is it Smalley? Stuart Smalley from Saturday Night Live. He, if anyone remembers him, well, now he's a United States Senator, actually. Someone will tell me later what his name is. It's escaping me this second. But the comedian, Stuart, who played the part of Stuart Smalley, used to do this bit where he said, "I'm kind enough, I'm smart enough, and gosh darn it, people like me." Now, of course, that doesn't help. Why? Because you don't even believe it. I mean, if you're feeling bad and you try saying that to yourself, honestly, I just don't think it's going to get you anywhere. And so that I think that that's a very unrealistic kind of way of saying it. So I'm going to suggest something else altogether that I feel is realistic and therefore works. Because honestly, in life, what's not realistic often usually does not work. And what works is something that has to do with reality. So what I'm going to suggest is that the way one parent oneself is how that depends on how the conversation they have in their head. Now, let me explain what I mean. And by the way, a conversation is two, I'll call them voices, but they aren't out loud. I'm not talking about crazy talk here. I'm talking about the fact that we think. So that we can think in two, I'll call them voices, but no one hears them, only you in your own head. So, what you think, many people do not realize this. You get to choose what you think. A lot of people are thinking very bad things. They're thinking, oh, I'm terrible, aren't I stupid, oh, aren't I an idiot, oh, I always make mistakes, that sort of thing. If you think those sorts of things, oh, I can't do it, I'll never be able to do it, other people get to do it, but I'm not able to because I'm so whatever, that's bad. If you think that way, first of all, I'll point out something about that. That is not a conversation, it's a monologue. And most people who have that kind of monologue, or sometimes it's referred to as a tape in their head, they feel as if that's simply who they are. And when we all talk to ourselves that way sometimes. And some people feel, well, that's just who I am. Now, I would actually suggest that for people who do that a lot, you might want to ask yourself, who do I sound like? And the answer almost always when I'm talking with people is one of your parents. You sound like one of your parents who was saying whatever those unkind things are. Or maybe you had a parent who didn't model how to have a conversation, as I'm going to explain. And so that in, so that you imagine, some people have parents who don't, who say very little. Either the parent is literally absent, either the parent passed away when they were young, or their parent isn't home very much, or their parent is just a person who ignores them and never says very much, or who really means something kindly, but it has too many other things to do, or isn't, or doesn't have a facility, isn't good at talking to their kids. So often when we have a parent who doesn't say anything or who's absent, either literally or figuratively, we think they're thinking something terrible, and we learn to say those things to ourselves. And besides, when we have a lot of adversity like an illness, we can get into a very negative frame of mind where we're saying really bad and mean things to ourselves. And saying bad and mean things to ourselves is the opposite of good coping. It makes us feel terrible. It's self-punitive, and it lowers our self-esteem, and it makes us feel awful. And it makes us less resilient and less able to handle the next thing. So people think they're stuck with those kinds of thoughts because it's very, because most people are not really fully aware. Some of you are, but a percentage of people are not fully aware that you choose what you think. These thoughts aren't just something that's happening to you. You get to pick what you think. You're the only one in there. You can think whatever you want. So you may have thought nasty, negative thoughts your whole life. It doesn't matter. You still could do otherwise, and I'm going to suggest how in a minute. So I have worked with many people, and first of all, when people aren't so great at coping and they have a harder time with coping, oftentimes they don't realize that other people's mental life is different than their own. I didn't realize it when I started working as a psychologist. I thought that everyone's mental life was like my own. And I did have a conversation in my head, fortunately, and I thought so did everyone else. But when I ask people, and when I ask people now, I find that many people only have the monologue. And usually when they have a monologue, it's something bad. And all of us can get into that from time to time, even if a lot of times we have the conversation. So I consider that being the punitive parent to oneself. Now, what's wrong with being the punitive parent to oneself? It means that literally we are making ourselves unhappy when we have another choice. So I'm going to give you the other choice in a minute. I encourage you to actually, if you're not used to it, to try. And sometimes even those of us who have a great conversation in our head have to ratchet up the other voice. And I have had to do that at times in my life also. So even for those of you who do have a conversation in your head, and by the way, for those people who do, you're probably thinking, what's she talking about? Doesn't everyone? And the people who only have the monologue, they're thinking, what's a conversation? What is she talking about? So I ask you to be open to the idea that there are other ways of thinking and that you can pick them. So I'm suggesting that if you have a punitive parent, if you have a punitive conversation in your head where you're saying nasty, unkind things to yourself, you are being the punitive parent to yourself, and you could choose to be otherwise. So you could choose another mode, which I'm going to call the benevolent parent. Now, the benevolent parent is not Stuart Smalley. I'm good enough, I'm kind enough, and gosh darn it, people like me. The benevolent parent is the one who says to themselves, okay, I know I made a mistake, but is there something I could do about it? Or, all right, I understand that I made a mistake. I guess it's my time to do that since I'm a human being. In other words, the other voice can come to your aid, the benevolent parent part of you. It's in there. You may not have exercised it very much, but it's in there. And you could get that benevolent part of yourself to respond to the punitive side, to the punitive voice. Because the part of you that says, oh, I'm just an idiot, I'm really stupid, I'm not good enough, I'm not capable, everything's horrible, I'll never be able to, whatever, isn't actually being any more realistic than Stuart Smalley saying, I'm good enough, I'm kind enough, and gosh darn it, people like me. Or the usual affirmations, I'm a terrific person, or whatever they tell people to say. So, I can't even listen to them because I wouldn't believe them. But you see, you shouldn't be believing something just because it's the worst thing you could think up. So that the benevolent parent is the one that comes back and says something reasonable, that is able to admit mistakes, that's able to look realistically, but responds kindly and in an encouraging way, so that you encourage yourself rather than just beat yourself up. And for those people who are very punitive, I suggest you give a little thought to the fact that you wouldn't probably treat anyone else that way. And even those of us who are usually fairly kind to ourselves, when we're being mean, we wouldn't probably ever treat another person or say the kinds of things to other people that we actually say to ourselves. So that what we need to do is have, is basically the way I think about it is, I think, you know, I'm one of the people in the world whose feelings I get to consider and should consider. I'm an actual person, and I need to treat myself in a kind and benevolent way, just as I would treat anyone else in a kind and benevolent way. And I, sometimes I laugh at myself because if I, let's say I call my house and I leave a message for myself to remember to do something. When I listen to it, I've always said please and thank you. And that's because that's actually how I treat myself on a regular basis. So being a benevolent parent to yourself doesn't mean that you say everything you did was great. It means that you have the courage to even acknowledge that not everything about you is great or everything you do is great or everything you think is great, but that you can help yourself by using that most adult, reasonable, encouraging, benevolent part of yourself to come to your own aid. And having a conversation in your head also involves other things that aren't necessarily about whether how we're judging ourselves. So I just want to give this as an example so maybe you could relate to doing this. But that is, we have a conversation in our head, for instance, when we decide to do something. Like, I think I'd like to have that piece of cake. Yeah, but didn't you promise yourself you were on a diet? Yeah, but it looks really good, you know, and so on. The up and back part of ourselves. So to that extent, most people are used to having that little debate with themselves about various things. Some people, by the way, just so you know this, don't even do that, you know. Like, you, when you were a kid, maybe you'd have said to yourself, oh, gee, I feel like getting on that motorcycle, and the other part of yourself would have said, yeah, but it's raining, and I don't have a helmet, and, you know, I've only ridden one once before. Yeah, but it really looks like fun, and so on, up and back. Whereas some people are just, I think I'll get on that motorcycle, and they do it. So that even those people who are impulsive, or even people who are very punitive in themselves and are very hard on themselves, can choose. You can choose to decide to parent yourself benevolently. So when I've worked with people before who aren't accustomed to that idea, the first thing they have to chew on is the fact that they actually get to choose what they think. But you do, because you are the only one in there. You're the only one in your own head. No one else is thinking those thoughts. You get to do it. Then they begin to think, well, what am I supposed to say to myself? I don't know what else to say. So it becomes a kind of practice sort of thing where a person has to actually practice saying these things, and I'm going to ask you to take my word that people who are happy and feel good about themselves and cope well actually have this conversation in their head. I'm not just making it up. And furthermore, they do something else in terms of parenting themselves. And that is an extremely important part. Punishment in shaping people doesn't really work. I don't have time to go into a long explanation, but it doesn't really help that much in child rearing. And so slapping, giving ourselves a slap, is not likely to help either. But the other thing is that what a lot of people don't realize is, in order to feel good about yourself, you not only have to encourage yourself and be benevolent to yourself, but you have to give yourself compliments. You actually have to give yourself compliments. Now, people who are happy, in case you already don't already give yourself compliments, are actually going around giving themselves compliments. Now, they don't do it out loud. You know, the mouth doesn't work. And your head does not get swelled from doing this because you're just thinking it and no one else can tell. And some percentage of you, I know there's an enormous amount of people on the line, believe me, because I've given this talk in person with people and they've spoken to me about it. People will say, well, I was told not to give myself compliments because that would, you know, that would be bad because I shouldn't get a swelled head or I shouldn't think too much of myself. No. In order to be happy, you have to think something positive and something that's real, though. I'm not saying say something crazy like I'm the smartest person ever or aren't I so the cleverest person who ever lived. No, but you get to say, nice job. Okay, I'm glad I gave that a try. Good for me. And so on. And when we are raising children, the rule of thumb for helping someone is a minimum of 4 compliments for every criticism that we give a child. But if a kid has some issues, then they need 8 compliments for every criticism. I know that sounds a little bit mechanistic, but that's what the research shows in my experience too. So this is the same for ourselves. When we need to frequently during the day give ourselves a compliment. So a compliment doesn't mean exaggerating, being ridiculous, giving positive affirmations that have nothing to do with reality, but it means saying, okay, nice try. And that leads me to the last thing that I want to say, or one of the last things, and that is that when we are giving compliments to ourselves and we're saying positive things to ourselves, we're still being realistic about that, and we are telling ourselves things within a realistic state. But one of the ways of doing that is really important, and that is we want to judge ourselves not on the outcome but on our behavior, so that I don't compliment myself because I cannot control other people. I cannot take credit for what other people think all the time either, because maybe they like me for reasons that are wrong, or they're overstating things, or they don't. Let's say I'm taking a class in school, and I do my best to get a good grade, but the teacher for some reason didn't like me, or there's many other people in the class that are smarter than I am, and so on. If I judge myself by the outcome, I cannot control the outcome. Other people judge us mostly for reasons that have to do with them. So I cannot judge myself by other people's decisions about me. The way I can judge myself is whether or not I conducted myself in a way that I could respect, as I suggested earlier. So for the school example, if I tried hard, I really gave it a good shot. Notice, I didn't say I tried my best or did perfect, because I don't know how to do that. I'm not perfect. I'm a human being. But if I gave it a good shot, I feel respect for how I approach things, I feel good about it, I can feel good and compliment myself and feel positive about how I've done regardless of the outcome. So that I want to leave you with that idea. And one last thought, and that is this works with other people too. And if anyone had questions about that, I would be happy to answer that. But I've talked for a long time now, and I'm wondering if anyone has any questions. So I'd like to open up the lines and see if people have any comments or questions or criticisms, whatever you might have.
And Tiffany, thank you, Dr. Morris. Tiffany, we'd like to open up the lines to provide a final opportunity for questions and answers.
I have a question from the line of Mary Carty.
Hello?
Hello. Thank you. I really find that was a very helpful conference.
Good. Thank you.
No, thank you. And I was wondering, as I'm listening to you, a while ago I used to journal,
mm-hmm.
which I found I worked through a lot of things that were going on. This was even before I had MS, much to the point that I have it now. But and I wonder if this works in working with that.
Well, that's such an interesting question. No one's ever asked me that before, and I haven't really thought about it a lot. But I think it's going to give me food for thought, and I think it's a really interesting question. The first thing that comes to mind, and I just assume you almost not comment on this, but because this is just something for you personally, and that is, I'd be curious to know, and this is rhetorical, don't answer me, if you went back and looked back and saw how you did approach yourself, it would be really interesting. But I think that it is a very interesting idea, because I think that it would be a wonderful way, really, of kind of training oneself that I haven't used. The way I've used it, the way I've worked with people, is to teach them how to have a conversation in their head by practicing, and also by I model how to do it. In other words, they can't think of what they would say that would be nice, so I give examples of what I might say if I thought this or that, whatever it was that they had said. But I think doing it in a journal would be really interesting because, first of all, you'd see how often you were tempted to say something not that nice about yourself. And you could really kind of examine that. In other words, is this realistic? Was it really that bad? Am I really, you know, I don't, and that begins to develop the other voice. It's the other voice that comes and says, is this real? Is it really that? Is that truly the situation? Is it actually that serious? Or and you might write down other ways of looking at the situation or a list of suggestions for yourself, the way you would give them for someone else. Sometimes when we do various kinds of therapy in a rehab setting, we use a videotape. And so we might video an exchange, maybe when you role play, maybe a little role playing between the therapist and the person they're working with, and then show it, because it's always easier to see a problem when it's out there than when you're thinking about yourself. Mm-hmm. And journaling would be a way of doing that. So I think that that's a very clever and excellent idea, and I'm going to give it thought and figure out how I could use that. So thank you.
Well, you're welcome. I know that when I was journaling, because you have a tendency to say, and then I thought, and it was always, I got so tired of seeing the capital I that I started, when I was talking about me, using a small I.
Well, that's a fine point. So we don't have time now to get into the fine points of journaling, but essentially, I think you have a wonderful idea, and I do appreciate that contribution.
Thank you. And I think it really helped me when I was doing it and helped me work a lot of things out.
Sure.
So I'm really very much pulled to start doing it again.
Well, very good. Excellent.
Thank you for your wonderful and enlightening talk.
Thank you.
Thank you. Does
anyone else have a question or a comment?
Your next question comes from the line of Rosemary Irving. Sorry.
Is this me, Rosemary?
It is.
Okay. I think that's wonderful to make us think about, you know, are we doing good? We feel good about ourselves. But one of my issues with specifically coping with change is that every day, every week, every month, there is something new to deal with.
Sure.
I can't walk better now. I mean, a month ago I could do this. I can't do this now. This is no fun.
Right. No, that's for sure. And so then what happens?
If it's a really bad day, sometimes I think, is this worth, you know, do I have to do this? Wouldn't it be better just to...
Well, okay, let me say something to you very personally, all right, because I am really hearing a lot of pain and a lot of kind of, that's a little bit of a drastic... I appreciate that many people, first of all, let me just speak to it a little more broadly and not only to you. Lots of people have those thoughts from time to time. And you have an ongoing adverse situation that you're having to deal with. So it's not surprising that you have those thoughts from time to time. However, if this is, and I don't want you to answer this, I'm just saying this for everyone, but if a person really feels that they are in that kind of pain and they're not sure why things are worth it, please go talk to someone. You can't just be sitting by yourself thinking this. Get someone else who might be able to help you to look at this another way. You know, if you remember when I said that I teach people how to have a conversation in their head, one of the things I said is that I model things. So I model things that people might think that they didn't think of themselves. And that's what one needs when they're in the kind of situation you're talking about. When you're feeling desperate and you feel like you can't figure out how I can go on and how this can work out for me and how could this ever get any better? You need sometimes we all, not just you, not just anyone who happens to be listening, all of us need some other point of view, someone else to step in and say, okay, I know it feels that terrible. Let's look at this. Let's think of other ways of approaching this. Or have you thought about this? Or here's something else, and so forth. Where, because we can get so deeply depressed and so deeply unhappy that we really can't see another way of looking at something. So I strongly do recommend, and of course I can't get into anyone's personal situation or yours even beyond what we've said, I do strongly recommend that sometimes we need someone else to model for us what we might think in that's different than what we're thinking. Maybe they wouldn't change your mind. Maybe nothing would change your mind. But at least we have to give that a shot because you're worth it and you matter and you are a person that matters and you need to get another point of view if you can't think of one of your own.
Thank you.
Sure.
Your next question comes from the line of Gail Fleeting.
Hello, Dr. Morris. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time and your talk tonight. Mine's sort of piggybacking. Rosemary's there. And as far as we do have the MS to cope with, but, you know, other things, like we had a family problem this year that got, you know, out of hand. And I was like, oh, my gosh, you know, I'm having such down days at certain times that I didn't think I'd come out of it at all. And then I started thinking, you know, like you're saying, do that talk in your head. But how long should you go talking in your head? Because my friends say I'm one of the happiest people they know. I'm the one that inspires them all the time to do stuff.
Right.
So when you have these down times, how long should you go before you have a better time before you go talk to a doctor?
Well, I don't know that there's one answer to that question. I actually don't really think there is. But, you know, when I listen to what you're talking about, what I'm thinking is of patients who I have had who I see from time to time, even when they're not in the down mood. In other words, I guess what I'm really suggesting is that when you know you have those kind of periods of time, which honestly I don't think are anywhere as unusual as I wish they were. I think that many people who are listening must have times like that. But I think that if you are prone to having times like that, even if other people don't know them and you manage to be able to put on a happy face, which I'm not saying isn't a good idea, but what I would do is I'd already know somebody, is what I'm suggesting. In other words, I don't think you should wait. What I would do if I were in your situation is I would establish a relationship with some therapist who I didn't go and see every week. I didn't just because maybe I'm not in need of doing that. But at least then, first of all, maybe I would find out that I could get something out of going a little more often for a while. But I want to emphasize, you're not having these thoughts because you've got some your mental illness or something. It's natural. So, but it's also, here's what I used to say when I was at the Institute full time. We saw every single patient in the hospital, someone from the psychology department. Now that isn't true anymore, but because of I don't want to get into insurance, but that's why. But at any rate, but it's just true. But we used to see every patient in the hospital, and I would appear on their schedule. They didn't ask to see me, and I always would explain to them that we see some of them. The psychology department sees every person in the hospital because it's pretty well assumed that anything is serious enough to land you in this place is going to have some impact on your life. Well, who could argue with that? If you wanted to argue with that, you'd probably look like you had poor mental health. So they all had to agree, yeah, that's kind of true. And then we'd get into a discussion. So the fact of the matter is that your parents, life, various things, did not prepare you for what you're having to face now. What you're facing now is bigger than, or I don't know, bigger. Yes, I think bigger. I think that's a fair statement. Is certainly different and probably bigger than what you ever thought you might have to face. And no one could prepare you for it. So doesn't it seem normal to talk with someone from time to time about it and that you might have down times where that would be the reason
okay.
We saw every person in the hospital is because it wasn't possible not to have something that you were mystified about or couldn't figure out how to deal with or were very unhappy or maybe even from time to time felt suicidal about. I'm using, I use that word.
So if it's okay to have these down times, if I'm understanding you to say that, but I really, that if that's normal, then I don't need to run out and see a doctor right away about it. It's just a down time. So
I don't know if
someone,
I'm not sure why you're asking the question. If you're asking because other people think you should or you think you should or you don't want to or whatever it is, but I guess what I'm suggesting really, what I'm really saying is that if I were a person who had down times, I would already have a relationship with a therapist, and I might call them when I felt really bad and make a visit because maybe I wouldn't want to have to go through life all by myself thinking these things. Maybe I'd want someone else who might be able to think of something else or at least listen to me because after a while my family's not going to be in the mood to listen. And not only that, I'm just not going to want to tell my friends. I'm not going to want to whatever. Maybe I want to have a certain relationship with my friends where I don't necessarily tell them every horrible thing that I think. I already am that way. I don't tell my friends every bad thing, every sad thought I have. So maybe I want someone I could do that with. So I guess that's what I'm suggesting is that if you know you do that, you might want to already have in place someone where you could have a drop-in, know them, they know you in your good and bad times, and they might be able to help you out in that way.
I see. Thank you very much.
Sure. Do we have time for another one?
Your next question comes from the line of Joanne.
Hi.
Hi.
Stuart Smalley is Senator Al Franken.
Thank you. I couldn't think of it.
He's got Paul Wellstone's seat, and Wellstone had MS. And the day he died, I was diagnosed with MS.
Oh, my. Thank you for that. Did you also have a question?
No, that was my contribution.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Maxine Smith.
Hi, Doctor.
Hi.
The comment the other caller made about the downtime.
Yes.
I understand that, and I have my downtime.
Sure.
And I made my daughter, she became like my psychologist.
Yes.
It really helps a lot to have somebody there
that understands. Yes.
And don't judge you because, like you said, you know, you don't want to tell your friend every little thing.
Well, that's true, but, you know, not everybody wants to tell their daughter either. And you sound like you're in a kind of good situation where you have someone there who can and is able to listen and do the right amount of saying something else to you that is helpful to you. But, you know, many people would not want to choose to do that because maybe they don't have a daughter that's there or they don't have the right age daughter or they're afraid to burden their daughter or whatever else it is. And it's good that it works that way for you and your daughter, but I think that, honestly, I have to say that that might be the exception rather than the rule.
Well, yeah, I think people have to, you know, every situation is different.
Right.
And everybody has to find something that works for them.
Yes.
You know, whether it's writing in a journal or, you know, talking to someone.
Yes.
You know, because the professional world is not, you know, always available.
That's very, very true.
You know, when we, you know, need it.
Yes.
And we just have to find something that works for us in that, you know, in that moment. It could be music,
But, you know, sometimes people get more down than that, or they don't have someone available. And
that's the sad part about it.
Yes, of course. But we can't let that just go without responding to it. And so that's why, I mean, to me, speaking of ending one's life is about the most serious thing someone could bring up with me. And
I've been there. You know,
well,
I was, you know,
right.
I was, you know, I tried that.
Oh, no, I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
But,
this
well, I'm glad you weren't successful.
Stage.
How's that? I'm glad that did not work,
well,
whatever,
you know,
that was.
You know, everything is a blessing. You know, it's a blessing that I'm here. And,
of course.
You know, I can
but we can't always be feeling that way, so sometimes
that's
we need to either reach out to someone who might be available to us or sometimes we go to a professional because maybe we don't have someone who, you know, is there for us in the way that you do. But thank you for sharing that, and I think you're absolutely right that we do need to reach out.
Yes, and thank you.
Sure.
Dr. Morris, do you have time for one or two more questions?
Sure.
Your next question comes from the line of Nancy Bowl.
Yes, Nancy.
My question is, well, first a comment. One thing that I have found that helps is try to concentrate on things that I can do.
Well, that's okay. That is a very excellent thing to say. Of course.
That learn how to adapt to do things that I didn't think I could do.
Well, that's very true also. And I just want to point out something about that. The really important thing about what you're saying is that it's crucial to do that at the times when you're not feeling down. You know, it's a little bit like meditating. Relaxation exercises. If the only time I practice my relaxation exercise is while I'm having a panic attack, it's probably not going to work that well. Whereas if I practice how I think of things that are positive, and I want to jump off on that for one moment and say that something that I do every day personally that I find extremely helpful is I ask myself every day, how can I make today a good one? Now, we're not going to talk about my life, but I've had ups and downs too. And they might not be the same as yours, and it's not a contest, right? But I say to myself every single day, how can I make today a good one? The reason this helps me is because it orients me, first of all, to the fact that I'm the one who's responsible for making today a good one, not someone else. No one else is going to be able, no one can do that for me. I can do that for me. But if the only time I did it was when I'm having some kind of horrible day, then I'm not going to be very successful at it. So that if we do that every day, particularly the days that are good days, we get in the habit of thinking that way. We get in the habit of not two sets of things. One is thinking of how could I make today a good one? In other words, what can I do? But also, I answer the question. In other words, I have an entire repertoire of things that I could do. If I'm in my house, I have more things to do to make today a good one. Now, they aren't all big things. Some of them are little. I mean, you might have a good evening by taking a bubble bath. I mean, I don't know. You know what I mean? Reading the National Enquirer or something. I mean, it doesn't have to be something important or big. But I have an entire repertoire of things that I could do to make today a good one. But I don't do that only, I don't start that or do that only on the days that might be the worst days. I do it every day, and it becomes a part of who I am. And it empowers me because at the same time that I'm taking responsibility for doing that, I realize that if I have the choice, and then the power rests with me to do it, and I feel stronger, and I am able to respond in the times when the times are tough. Do you follow me?
Yes, I do.
So I thank you very much for your comment because I think that's really important.
And instead of these things that I have adapted to be able to do, the ones that I really enjoy that I find that I can relax at doing are things that I try to do more often.
Sure. Exactly. Because you're accustomed to doing it, and you can get into it, whatever it is. You can get into it. So I think that is very important and a very good point.
Thank you. You had a very, very nice conference tonight.
Thank you. I appreciate your saying that. And we have time for one more. Is that it?
Yes.
Okay.
Your next question comes from the line of Russell Kaiser.
Hello.
Yes. I greatly enjoyed talking this evening, and I learned a lot.
Good. Now, thank you so much.
You're welcome. I work with people that I help find an appointment for disabilities.
You help find the plans? You help find
I help people with disabilities find an appointment.
Oh, employment. Okay, great.
Yeah.
Oh, fabulous.
And am I more sensitive to comments about people's disabilities than normal?
Are you?
Yeah, I had a situation today I was.
People feel that you're oversensitive about comments about disabilities?
No, they haven't talked to me about it yet, but I feel that I'm more sensitive.
Well, good. I think you should be. Who would be more sensitive to people, to comments about people with disabilities than someone who's familiar with people who have disabilities? We know the most. I'm very sensitive to those comments, and I don't mind speaking up either. Although I think that the times have changed a great deal over the years that I've worked in this field. And one of the things that I see is that the people who were kind of almost militaristic from the community of those with disabilities back in the 80s when... you might not remember back then, but there didn't used to be curb cuts. And it was a really wild and crazy idea to have buses that were, wheelchair accessible and so forth. And people fought for those things. And people began to realize that there's life after disability and that you can get out there in a wheelchair or whatever device you happen to be in and that you're just as much a person as anybody else. And I think that basically the attitudes to some degree have changed. And maybe I would just end with one other little thought, and that is for those of you who go out there and have to face other people and sometimes maybe get negative things, feedback, it reminds me of a group I did when I was very first starting. This was a group of spinal injured patients where it was an actual group. We'd meet in the hospital, and one of the patients had a hat, and it said "It talks." He was quadriplegic, and he was a very funny guy. Anyway, so we got into discussing what other people thought of them, and it was really fascinating because what everyone, including myself, but all the other participants too, realized was that people had different ideas of what other people were thinking about them that may or may not be true, so that. So they began to talk about what they thought that other people were, how they might be judged by other people on the street and so forth. And it was really fascinating to hear the differences between what some people thought and what other people thought. So I think that there is actually less prejudice and that hopefully we don't imagine more than there actually is. There's plenty still, but it is improving to some degree. But that this is a particularly important reason that we maintain our boundary between what we believe and what someone else believes. Because if someone else is going to have some ignorant idea, it doesn't mean that they are not the judge of who we are. And therefore, they can think what they want. But it doesn't have to be what you think. And in your case, if you want to stand up for someone else who has a disability, I say good for you. And I certainly would encourage that. I think it's great to be sensitive to what other people think and to try and help, maybe in a nice way. In other words, you don't have to be confrontive. You don't have to be nasty back. But to say things that might be thought-provoking and help other people to have greater sensitivity, just as you've come to have greater sensitivity.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Morris, for presenting such an engaging and interactive topic on coping with change. And this does conclude our program this evening. And I'd like to thank everyone on the line for joining us tonight and also mention our program sponsors again, Bayer Healthcare and Biogen Iodec, who provided limited sponsorship for our educational conference series. And we do appreciate their support. If you do have further questions, please contact us at 1-800-344-4867. And all participants on the call today are invited to remain on the line and give their responses to three very short survey questions. I hope you all enjoy a pleasant evening.
Ladies and gentlemen, please stand by. The polling session is about to begin. Ladies and gentlemen, we have reached the polling session of the conference call. To answer each question, you will need to press the corresponding number on your telephone keypad. Question 1, I learned something that I will use in my day-to-day life. Again, question 1, I learned something that I will use in my day-to-day life. For yes, press 1. For 2, press no. Question 2. The content was presented clearly and in an unbiased way. For yes, press 1. For 2, press no. Question 3. The speaker was knowledgeable about the topic. For yes, press 1. For 2, press no. This concludes the conference call. You may now disconnect.